Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Movie Log with Izzy and David. This week, we are going to discuss the 2010 film The Tempest, directed by Julie Taymor, starring Helen Mirren, Ben Whishaw, Jemin Hansu, and Felicity Jones. So, Izzy, why did you pick this film?
I picked this movie for this episode because I'm a big Shakespeare nerd. I like watching his plays, and I like how people interpret different plays differently, and I think that's really fun. I'm trying to get you to watch a little bit more fun Shakespeare things that I've watched because I want someone to talk to about them, since most of my friends couldn't care less. And so I just was like, "Ooh, you should watch this one. I have really fond memories of this one." So
one of the things that we did as a family growing up, we went and saw, you went to conservatory theater camps during the summer, and a lot of them were Shakespeare based. And then we went and saw plays at Cow Shakes,
which is a local theater in our area.
And so Shakespeare has been in our family. So I thought it was a great opportunity for us to kind of connect over something that has been in both of our lives. So yeah, it was a great choice, I think.
So for those who haven't seen the play or have seen this movie is, this is about a shipwreck. Bunch of people are shipwrecked on an island caused by a sorcerer, Prospero, who lives on this island. In this movie, it's Prospera, since the character is played by Helen Mirren, and it's just Helen Mirren's character revenge on people who have wronged her in the past.
Well, they're the reason why she is
on the island in the first place.
Yes,
her and her daughter Miranda are on the island in the first place.
In this version, she was the Duchess of Milan, and then she ends up being, her brother usurps her, ships her off to this island, and this is her chance. They're sailing by the island, and this is her chance to exact revenge. So she's on the island with her daughter that's pretty much grown up on the island just with her.
So I wanted to talk a little bit, starting off with the big guns, about how one of the topics that come up most frequently when you are a Shakespeare nerd, and especially a female Shakespeare nerd, is female roles in Shakespeare. There is that usual dynamic when it comes to women's characters. They are usually lovelorn, or they are abused, or they have minor characters, so they're not really counting as female roles. There's always been debate on if Shakespeare is a misogynist, which, frankly, he would have been, because he is a Renaissance writer. He is of the 14th century, 15th, 16th century, so it makes sense why people would have that debate. One of the also reasons
he's of the 1500s or the 16th century.
What did I say?
You said 14, 15, 16
century.
Yeah, but you like combined 300 years into.
Yes, because that's roughly when the Renaissance happened. I was saying Renaissance in general.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought you meant Shakespeare, and I was like, that's a long career.
No, Shakespeare was born in the 1500s and died in the early 1600s.
Yeah, he died 1616?
Yes, on his birthday. Or at least people think he died on his birthday.
So being a man, what you're saying is being a man of the Renaissance, even if he was the most liberal man of the Renaissance.
Because there is an argument that some of his women's characters are actually feminist characters and actually helped bring women's representation and women to the stage. So there are things that Shakespeare did after he died well, Shakespeare's writing did after he died, that are both misogynist and, in the sense, feminist. I don't know if they are the opposite words of each other, but...
Well, you can have a character that, and a plot line that is from a male-dominated society, and you're... in your own personal views would be considered misogynist now, would not necessarily, as you read it and reinterpret it through the centuries, if you write it, if it's written really well as a complex character, you can find the deeper meanings to these characters. If it's written as just a stereotype, it's going to be really hard. And I think it's one of the things that his writings show, is that they're complex characters. Even the minor characters are complex characters, and they contradict each other, themselves, a lot. And so it makes it a much more in-depth and interesting conversation.
Because for every Taming of the Shrew, there's Merry Wives. To me, they're very opposite energy when it comes to female roles, though I have read about some an Australian female director who took Taming of the Shrew and made it a feminist reading. So there are some interpretations that you can do with Shakespeare that both help women and put their story on stage, which is why I found this story very interesting, because without any of the roles changing, only 10% of the lines in Tempest are female characters, which, if you think about it, there's only one designated female character, and I'm not including Ariel in the female roles because Ariel sometimes is played as a feminine character, sometimes played as a gender-neutral character. In this movie, Ariel is played by Ben Whishaw, who is a man. So I think it's just very interesting. So if you think about that, only 10% of the lines with one female character in the whole play, that's a lot of lines for the female compared to, like, As You Like It, which has a lot of the percentage of the play is female lines, but they also have multiple female roles.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense that you only have one designated female role. And the female role you have is also an innocent. So her role in the film is, or in the play is reduced. And like in some of the more, some of the films like As You Like It, or even, Much Ado About Nothing, the female characters are driving parts of the plot. And Miranda in this movie doesn't drive as much of the plot. She reacts to it, but Prospera is the one that's driving the plot in this movie, in the play. And Miranda doesn't have much choices.
Which is very interesting, in my opinion, because Miranda is viewed as this, like, maiden phoenix, which was put into a book called Women of Will, which is really interesting because the Maiden Phoenix shows up a lot within his writing, which is kind of like the daughters redeem the father's mistakes. And without Miranda, Prospero and Ariel, which sometimes is played by a woman, without those two women in Prospero's life, Prospero doesn't forgive the people who have wronged him in the past. So even though she's such a minor character, or she doesn't really affect the plot, she does affect the ending. Without Miranda, there is no forgiveness.
Yeah, it's her innocence that drives Prospera forgiveness. Her and Ariel remind Prospera of her humanity. It also brings up one of the things in this film that kind of made me go, I never thought about that with this character. One of the reasons why Prospera loses her dukedom is because she is obsessed with her books and learning, and it's the same as the regular play, and removes herself from humanity as she is learning and studying her books, which is where she gets her magic from. And that allows her brother to usurp her and send her off. That's pretty standard Tempest. In this instance, having it played by Helen Mirren, it made me think about the juxtaposition that we have in our society about women who learn, about how they lose their femininity as they become smarter. And there's a lot of stereotypes around smart women and learning and are you going to get a husband or, you know, those type of stereotypes. And as I was watching it, I was like really interested in the fact that as she becomes towards the end more engaged in humanity, doesn't lose her strength and all that, but she does end up at the end of the play, Prospera gives up her power by throwing her staff away, which made that a much more powerful scene of like, to re-engage in society, she has to give up what she's worked her whole life for, which I don't know if that's what they were going for in the play, in this movie adaptation, but having Helen Mirren play that part really kind of drove home some of the things about what is expected of women's roles in society. Even though this play was written 400 years ago, and there's definitely structure and classism and all that stuff in this play, when women start to study and better themselves, the pushback on society, like her brother probably had a much easier time usurping her by her being just a smart woman. All the brother had to do in this play is say, see, she's off studying witchcraft and boom, she's gone.
See, I also thought it was very interesting that they chose not to do the closing monologue. They did it, but as a song and over the end credits. But I thought it was very interesting in the fact that they didn't. One of the closing monologues or the epilogue themes is that we're all actors, and these are, so if we've offended you, these spirits, they're just actors. I'm an actor. Please set me free from this story by clapping your hands and things like that. And I thought it was very interesting that they didn't allow Prospera to be like, it's okay, I'm an actor. It's, you know, this whole story is a fragment of some dude's imagination, which I thought was very interesting because it didn't allow the movie to have an out, you know,
with Prospera's character.
Prospera is now the Duke, but she is now powerless. And I thought that was very interesting. It's always interested me, even with just a straight play, but it definitely interested me when it was a woman playing Prospera, because to get power, she has to become powerless. And it's such an interesting dynamic within the play. She's also learned that her power corrupts her. And since her magic, she kept, you know, lying to her subjects, which would be Ariel and Caliban, you know, she abuses them, she manipulates them, and she realizes that her powers don't equate her with kindness and the right to rule.
They keep referring to her magic as white magic. And when you read about the play and stuff like that, and that the Caliban's mother, I forget her name.
Sycorax.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
This island
is referred to as black magic. And for me, I thought it was more of there's the magic of book learning, and then there's the magic of nature, which is, what's her name?
Sycorax.
Her magic. And that to me is much more of a, either one of them are neutral. It's how you use it that makes the magic good or bad. Like you said, she was realizing that her magic was corrupting her. And at the end, I thought the most cinematic scene in the entire film, because all plays filmed sometimes have a, even if they're in the middle of a beautiful island like Hawaii, like this one was filmed, have a stagey feel sometimes. And the most cinematic scene was her final confrontation with Caliban. They didn't say anything, and you can see that she senses her failures with Caliban and the way that she treated him and the way that how it didn't make her a good person, which is another reason why they didn't give her the out at the end. The last monologue is basically the out. And you're basically releasing Prospero from all the crimes that he has done in the, during the play. They don't give her that in the, in this movie version. And Caliban, you can see the hurt and the anger in his face. And as he leaves, you know that that's going to fester. Very cinematic. And it, for me, it was very, the most powerful scene in the movie. So we kind of touched on the whole gender bending, having Helen Mirren playing Prospera in the movie. And although the last, I've seen the Tempest like two or three times on stage. And usually I've seen Before You Were Born was one of them.
No, I'm going like this because you have seen it way more than twice, because I've done the Tempest twice, and we've seen Tempests outside of that. It's all semantics, but I was just like, sorry.
Oh gosh, that means I've seen it. There's the one time it's
a, there is so, a reason so,
so,
why.
So I've seen it now. If I count your versions, because I know your versions
were shrunk because I'm a kid at the time and they don't want to.
You were doing one as a kid and then one as a teenager. So the teenager one was longer and more consistent. The one when you were like 10 or 12, 10, 11 was really short.
Because they didn't want us talking about all the horrible things, you know?
Yeah. And then I saw at, we saw it together. Mm-hmm. And then I saw it up in Seattle, performed there.
So there is a reason why this play is the number 15th most performed Shakespeare play.
I thought somebody told me that I was reading that at one point it was the most done play.
I wouldn't think that's a wrong statistic. Granted, plays
or a version of it, version of it.
People change and plays go, and my statistic is from 2000 up until 2000, so it might have changed by then. But it's 15. It was definitely 15 with like Hamlet, Midsummer's being in a little bit higher.
Okay, but no, it's though the what I read was that it was the Tempest or versions of the Tempest, because one of the things that was very common in the 70s and 1800s was to rewrite versions of Shakespeare's plays. And there was a version I was reading about. I couldn't believe they did this. It's like, there's like a sister, Prospero has a sister Miranda has a brother. There's like, they add like tons of characters to it. I think because so everybody has a speaking part, like sometimes they do like in.
Well, it was really famous too, like 100 years after Shakespeare, to write happy endings for like Romeo and Juliet and King Lear. And to be honest, we almost lost the ending to King Lear because people were overperforming the happy ending of Cordelia being. Spoiler alert, Cordelia not dying, her husband saving her and her father, they live happily ever after, and the people who've wronged them in the past who are all, you know, get committed to jail for their crimes. So it's like, we almost lost a really poignant ending to a wonderful Shakespeare play because a lot of people couldn't handle the sad.
Well, I think it's called a tragedy for a reason. And but then in the 1800s especially, there was people's interpretation of Shakespeare became a popular thing, like so-and-so's version of The Tempest. And so it was kind of weird because it's like they would add certain characters or they would subtract. It's basically kind of like how when you have a book nowadays made into a movie and the screenwriter and the director add characters, take away characters, change plot points. It's the same idea.
And we do that. Technically, we still do that now with like 10 Things I Hate About You, you know.
And Clueless.
And Clueless. Clueless is a Jane Austen adaptation, but it's very similar in the sense of like it's a classic story that we formed characters into each other, take away characters, things like that. With 10 Things I Hate About You, you know, there's no play equivalent to Michael's character. You know, he's just there. You know, and so there's no, you know, so there's these characters that get added and taken away. And we still do that to this day with, like, Prospero's books, which is another Tempest movie from the 80s.
Well, because John Gielgud, since the 60s, wanted to make a film version of Tempest. And he, like, worked, tried to get so many different directors to do it. And finally, Peter Greenaway said he would do it with him. And he's an experimental filmmaker, so that film was really experimental, avant-garde. And I really enjoyed it at the time. And I can't remember – gosh, I can't remember. It's been, I think it's the last time I saw it was in the early 90s. So other than it being having a lot of nudity and having really cool imageries and some of the best readings of lines of this play by John Gielgud, that's pretty much my memory of that film.
That's fair. So with gender bending, because gender bending is becoming a lot more common within Shakespeare plays, to you, what makes a good gender bend character? And how do you think gender bending is used to uplift Shakespeare? And how do you think gender bending takes away from the story?
Well, it depends. For me, if you're going to switch genders of the character, we saw a version done, was it 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
Yeah, on stage.
On stage, where they just flipped two of the characters, two main characters. And so it felt kind of weird because the rest of the play was just standard. And it worked. I mean, the play was good, but it didn't. I don't think the effect that they were going for was pushed out there about men and women's roles in society. I don't think it was as strong a message as if they had not switched the entire cast, but you know, made it more through the entire cast, having different people play different parts. I've also seen it done really well, and you and I have talked about this, where different adding and switching gender roles makes you question or make certain things, you look at certain things differently, which I really like, because it's like it's another interpretation of it. But it also, I know this is nothing that Shakespeare intended, and I know that when this was written, that was the furthest from the author's mind, but it makes your imagination reexamine your place and what society is doing, which is the whole point of going to really good films and plays and good art. So I find that the best part about it is when there's a full concept behind it versus when you see it, it feels gimmicky. A good example for gimmicky is there was a gangster movie made of Macbeth back in the day with John Turturro. And you would think a gangster movie with the storyline of Macbeth would be awesome. And it wasn't. They pretty much had the idea of turning everybody into a gangster, and that was it. And the movie was pretty mediocre/bad. So that's what I'm talking about gimmicky. Like, they have the initial concept, but they don't follow through it all the way.
I think gender bending is, like you were saying with, like, before this, it's the same. You have to use gender bending the same way that you use your setting. Because you can put Shakespeare in a modern text or a modern setting, but sometimes it doesn't work. Like, you're not just going to put them in a gangster time period or as gangsters without actually adding something to it, or Much Ado About Nothing in the 70s just because you loved the 70s. You actually have to have a feeling, and it has to add to the story sometimes. And sometimes gender bending doesn't add to the story the same way that the setting doesn't add to the story.
Yeah, so it's having the complete concept and the complete follow through. I also feel like if you're going to go in a certain direction, let the audience know right off the bat. Because at certain times, you're watching a movie 5-10 minutes into, or play 5, 10 minutes into it, and your brain is starting to settle into, this is what the story is. And then in minute 12 to 15 comes the change up. That's too late. It has to be right at the beginning. So as an audience member, you know, this is where this play film is going. And like this movie, Prospera was introduced to us second shot.
Yeah, I think this movie did a really good job with the beginning scene of telling us that this is kind of going to be a little bit more avant-garde, a little bit more different than a straightforward Shakespeare play. And I think that it was really interesting to show.
And maybe it wasn't second shot. Maybe it was the second scene. But it was really early.
It was really early because it was a really interesting choice for the director to have Miranda running around the island intercut with scenes of the boat. Because it kind of gave this duality and it showed you that it's a little bit more complicated. This is what we're going to do. This is a little bit more different. We're not just going to show you a shipwreck and then just be like, oh, by the way, the shipwreck was caused by a magician. We know that the ship is being caused by a magician because they make sure that we know. Do you think that this movie did a really good job with the gender bending, or do you think that it didn't change the story at all?
No, like I said earlier, it made me think about certain things differently, like the whole education aspect that I never even thought about, because of Prospero always being played by a man, in the versions I've seen, him studying magical text or knowledge wasn't really an issue, because it's like, yeah, it's a natural part of this society. And with Prospera studying text and then her brother using that against her to get her out of to usurp her, that bring up all those issues of educating women and from history, you know.
I also wanted to add this. I thought it was very interesting to have to show her doing alchemy in the flashbacks, because alchemy is a very historical thing that women did in the Renaissance era, especially women who had the freedom to do that. So like, duchesses and princesses and things like that. And there's actually famous alchemists who were women. So I thought it was very interesting to have some like historical realism.
But then again, you have stories from the same era that women who were alchemists or knew certain things of science, eventually that was turned against them. You had to be very careful in society at that time, because even though there was certain people had the certain women could do this, most of them were of nobility because they were protected by their families. Unfortunately, that's just the way history is.
Well, I also think that it really works too, because it is a mother-daughter story. Ultimately, this is a mother-daughter story because, you know, she's out there looking and caring for her daughter. She wants the best for her daughter. And it's a very sweet relationship if you think about it, because Prospera wants her daughter to be taken care of and be protected so nothing like what happened to her will happen to her daughter. And I think adding a mother character more than a father character adds a little bit more extra oomph to it, because it's not the stereotypical, like, you're my property, I want you to marry who I want you to marry, and you gotta do this for me, blah, 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 that you see in the original text. With the mother story, it kind of adds a little bit more of that protection element. I want the best for my daughter. I don't want what happened to me to happen to her. I want her to be protected in the world. And I think that's a very interesting side of the story that doesn't get really talked about a lot.
Yeah, but it also made it so that she does approve Ferdinand. She makes Ferdinand work for her approval to marry Miranda. And again, it highlights for me, she wants her daughter to be protected and not have the life she has, that Prospera had. So what's the one thing she doesn't do that entire 12 years of stuck on the island, which is teach her anything? She is at age 15, if you go by the age in the play, because she was 3 when they got stranded on the island, and she 12 years had passed. So she's 15, and she is an innocent. So another choice that Prospera made, according to this interpretation, is to not have the life that I had with all the problems I had. I'm not going to teach you anything. Where in the other text and the other interpretations is Prospero he's protecting his daughter, but he also thinks of his daughter as lesser. The scene where Helen Mirren grants Miranda and Fernand to marry Miranda, when she is saying, I'm giving her to you, she's yours to taketh. It's not like the way that Helen Mirren is saying it, it's more like I'm approving this marriage, where in traditional versions, it's like you've met my expectations. I am now giving you ownership of my daughter, is more the interpretation.
I do think it's fair. I think one of the things that I also think with Miranda and Prospera's relationship is that she's never had a father figure in her life, so it makes the island and Ferdinand more enticing, because one of the things about the original script is there's only 2 men on the island, with her father and the slave Caliban. Well, without a father figure, the only person that she's ever met is Caliban, who Prospera has diminished, beaten, you know, pushed Caliban to this certain aspect. So when she sees Ferdinand for the first time and her mother is a little bit more understanding about Ferdinand, Miranda, who's only met one other man in her entire life, who was like, this is not a man that you want to marry because he is beneath us, it kind of drives a little bit more of this like colonialism that a lot of people read into The Tempest with Caliban and Ariel. And especially because Caliban is played by Jimon Hounsou. And so I think it's very interesting interpretation of the Caliban, Miranda, Ferdinand aspect of it.
Yeah, a lot of people tend to forget when they talk about the colonialism of the play, they tend to forget about Ariel being also controlled and under the thumb of Prospera. They tend to forget that those two were part of the island before Prospera got there, or Prospero. And so when there's a lot written about Caliban, and there's a little bit written about Ariel, and that's where you get the different interpretations of Ariel being more feminine or gender neutral. So Prospera doesn't feel threatened. Also, the Ariel working with Prospera versus Caliban not trying to get back his mother's island, because, of course, she was the one that had the power on the island before Prospera got there. And so there's definitely a lot of colonialism going on. And there was actually books and mostly pamphlets being written during his time, questioning whether it was correct for Europeans to be colonial. So it wasn't like an abstract thought.
Because Virginia, the colony of Virginia, had already been made during this time. And a lot of people always say, this play reflects colonialism that showed up, showed up after Shakespeare's death. Towards the end of his life, there was the great expeditions to the new land that he would have read about, would have seen. People have gone over there.
The shipwreck that a lot of people think that he based the shipwreck on happened in the early 1600s. And there were reports of it printed in papers and in pamphlets by 1610. So he wrote this play in 1611. He would have been familiar with the shipwreck. And it was it was on an island in the Caribbean, and it was a ship that was going to Virginia at the time. So, yes, there was like this traveling and the opening up of the world, but there was actual books. Now, I don't want to say books like what we would consider books, like more like pamphlets at the time because printing was expensive. There was actual arguments being made by people that is colonialism correct. Now, they were not the majority. They were more fringe, but it wasn't like an unknown thought. And you have the Spanish going into Central America by this time, well established. You have the the Caribbean being open, and you have also islands and stuff like that happening on Africa, islands out off of the coast of Europe and Africa being settled. You also have parts of Africa being colonized at that point from European powers, and so it's not like this is an unknown thing. You know, it's like this is the world that he's living in. And I think it's very important to remember too that he wrote a lot of stuff where we know the source material, and you can point to parts of this play coming from the source material of the accounts of these shipwrecks. Of the source material, some people argue that he must have read the essays by Montaigne. There's one he wrote called On Cannibals, where he argues that there are certain societies should be insulated from colonialism and from European influence because of the way that it wrought destruction on their civilizations when Europeans showed up. So there's a good chance he read that, or at least knows that was being out there, because these ideas weren't new at the time. So, and there's people that argue also when you read about Shakespeare analysis that of the different things that were going on in London and in Europe. So writing plays, you would want to make sure that you were up on the most recent stuff. It's like when we watch TV shows now, and it's like ripped from the headlines on their plot of what this TV show is about, especially like Law and Order. It's like ripped from the headlines, the story. So he did very similar stuff. So as it's not a shocker to me that he would have some ambiguity in his play about colonialism and making Prospera, making her the person who is also being the oppressor after she got kicked out, makes it a much more dynamic play. Everybody has these flaws. Everybody has issues. Everybody is not a good guy at the end. The characters in this play, really interesting to me because nobody comes out of this play clean, which when you think about when it was written 400 years ago, this one has a thing where it's like, no, there's nobody here you can openly root for because everybody is flawed, and that's the world we live in. For me, watching a play on film, because I know this was made as a film, and there's definitely some very cinematic aspects to the way that it was staged. Did you break away from the fact that it was a filmed play? Or did you always feel it was kind of stagey? Or do you think that Julie Taymor did a really good job of making it cinematic?
I think she did an adequate job of making it cinematic. There have been many plays, many movies based on plays that I have told you that I didn't like because they stuck it in a room. They stuck the actors in a room and just cut the camera back and forth.
Yeah.
And after a while, that gets really annoying, which is one of the reasons, a little controversial here, that I didn't like Denzel Washington's Fences, because I love that play, but I couldn't stand the movie because the movie, except for like maybe two scenes outside the house, was just them inside the house going back and forth with the camera. And a beautifully acted, but after a while, you're just like, oh, reaction shot, talking, reaction shot, talking. And one of the things that I really liked about this movie is that it used the island to its advantage. Usually when you have a staged production, it's only, you know, you only get one section of the island to focus on, and you just have to dress it up differently to show, ooh, a different part of the island. But I think that they used the island to its to their advantage. So it seemed like there was these journeys going on, and that they seemed like there was more going on than just talk, 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 reaction shot, talk, talk, reaction shot. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about this play, this movie, which might not necessarily work as anything other than a play getting turned into a movie, is that they did like a lot of lines off camera, and then they would show like a different part of the island, which kind of added to this whole like symbiotic relationship that everybody on the island had with each other, because each problem and each thing kind of came from this one central point, which is they're all terrible people.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's funny because it's one of Shakespeare's last plays that he wrote individually, that people think that he wrote by himself. There's a couple more that came after this that he wrote with other playwrights. There's one that came right before this, Timon of Athens, which
I've always read it as Timon, and I always feel really weird because everybody says Timon, and I just immediately think of The Lion King. So I always think of it as Timon because it sounds a little bit less like a comedy in my brain.
Well, it's not a comedy.
No, it's not.
But that one was the one he wrote when he wrote that, and they're pretty sure that was it. Thomas Middleton was the other writer that wrote it with him, and so they're pretty sure about that being co-written with somebody. And then there's this one, The Tempest, and there's also Winter's Tale. I think it came at the same time. And they're pretty sure those are the last two that he wrote as the exclusive playwright. I would argue that there's always, as you're doing a play and you're working with so many people, there's people are making contributions all the time. We can get into the, did Shakespeare write his own plays or not?
He did. If you don't think so, you're stupid.
No.
Yes.
Well, there's a lot of great Shakespearean scholars who would make an argument that he didn't write the plays. I always go back to these two things, why I don't fall into the group of people that argue that he didn't write the plays. One, the main person who came up with the idea that maybe Shakespeare didn't write his plays, it was very elitist, and their whole point was Shakespeare did not have the education or the smarts because of where he came from to write. But it also is the whole thing is like he actually had an above average education for the time period. In fact, when 70% of all of England at that time was illiterate, he actually had an education that took him into what we would call high school now. But that was more than a lot of people had at the time. So he would have known Greek, he would have known Latin, he would know how to read and write, he would have been able to read things when pamphlets were handed out. He actually knew what they said. He would have somebody tell him what it said. And so he had plenty of skills to do that. That's number one. Number two, this is the one that I always kind of like get stuck on, is the technology of the day. There wasn't a computer. There wasn't a typewriter. What you ended up with is you have what's called a scrivener. And they are the people who would take what you wrote and they would write it out, copies of it, for the cast. We know the different scriveners people used because of their style. We actually can trace, this number A wrote this play out because he liked to use a lot of dashes. He would shorten words. He would use colons instead of commas. So that's actually altering the text. When you start reading the text and go, well, this doesn't follow the text he did. It's like, who copied it? Who worked on it? We actually know that. And then when they printed it out, the printers, we actually trace the guys who set the print in the folios. There was setter number, setter A, B. There's one called setter F. We can trace them through the actual folio because the way that they set and they would use different letters and all that kind of stuff, So to sit there and go, well, this passage is reads differently than that passage, so therefore this was written by somebody else. I was like, dude, there are so many variables in the actual technology of the time. There was also no rules. They were setting, of grammar. They were changing words all the time, changing spellings all the time. They were changing the way things were written. Literally in the time period that he was writing, from the beginning to the end of his career, the rules had changed over and over. He was part of it. He changed a lot of it, but so were the other playwrights and other writers. So I when they started examining texts for this text was written by author A and this text was written by author B, it's like, well, I don't really follow that, because we also know that they had to get different versions of the play and put them together. Like, one was performed 5 years ago and one was performed 10 years ago. And they had to get people's parts and actually assemble them to get the full version of the play when they were assembling the folio. So one, the people that are usually believe that he didn't write the plays are usually coming at it with there's no way that this person wrote these plays, because he has to be somebody from nobility or somebody else, because they have an elitist point of view of he didn't have the right stuff to write the plays. And then the following thing is that they totally ignore the fact that everything was up in the air at that time, and there was so many other influences by the technology of the period into the actual finished product that it could look very inconsistent. That's why they argue there's certain inconsistencies in the plays, is that when they were assembling the folio, they may have had two different versions of the play and that they were combining them, which is why you have maybe certain scenes repeating, things like that.
Well, that's also really important, because this is a little Shakespeare fact that, you know, where it's like, in Hamlet, it's like, oh, will this tutu flesh will melt? That's a line that a lot of that if you pick up different texts and stuff, gets changed a lot because of printing and things like that.
The printing process influenced a lot of Shakespeare's plays. Now that over the last 100 years, they've gone back and they've reexamined it and they've realized, oh, they were using the long F, which was known as the long S, they actually meant the long F. So it wasn't wise, it was wife all along. Things like that.
That's a little spiel for you guys. We are a family who believes that Shakespeare was Shakespeare. No, you know, he can use outside sources. He used other people in his life as inspiration, as help. But we do believe that he is an author of his work.
And when he worked with other playwrights, it's pretty obvious.
Yes. There's a reason why it's called the Shakespeare Sonnet. He created that format. There's a reason why it's called the Shakespeare Sonnet.
Also, if you're going to have a conspiracy theory, having 74, I think last count, 74, 77 different people who could have been, is not a very defined conspiracy.
My favorite – okay, this is the last thing, then we have to go back to the movie. But my favorite conspiracy is Edward de Vere. I think it's Edward de Vere, because Edward is six letters – D is two letters and Vere is four letters. But in the first folio, it's like there's like on the title page, the way that they made the title page, there's six letters, two letters, and four letters. So everybody thinks like that. That's a code. And I'm like, you've watched Nicolas Cage movies too much with your national treasure. We got to find all the clues in the first folio. And it just makes me laugh. I also think it makes me laugh because if you look up Edward de Vere, that theory is he was the Duke of Oxford, I believe, and that theory started in Oxford and things like that. So it's like the people who want that to happen are the people who would make it good for them, you know?
Yeah, and one last little thing on this before we move on to the movie, because this is essentially about The Tempest, is if you're going to have, like I said, if you're going to have a conspiracy theory, starting out and saying that there's no way he can write something, and then every time somebody brings up the fact that we actually know a lot about Shakespeare, they always say, we know nothing about Shakespeare. Well, for the average person in his social standing at that time, we actually know quite a bit about Shakespeare. His educational level was actually quite high for that time of period. And he was in a profession that was would have been for his standing acceptable. And he treated it a lot like a lot of craftspeople at the time. He worked really hard. He kept on writing. And then when it was over, he retired and really didn't think much of it because it was just his craft to get to pay for the bills. And it was actually people after he passed away that saved his writing. And there you can go into how much work that they had to do to create those folios. And we know that there's plays that he participated in or wrote that have been lost. And he was also working. He also had playwrights that worked under him that he was coaching that would later go on too. So it's a very common thing at that time period. Think about how we produce films and plays now. A lot of people were involved. And so, you're going to have different versions and different forms and people talking about different things. But we actually do know quite a bit about him because he was so famous at the time.
Also, with the Edward de Vere one, they all think that Edward de Vere was Queen Elizabeth I's secret lover because of Midsummer Night's Dream. And I just find that really funny. They think Midsummer Night's Dream is also one of those national treasure. We got to find all the clues for his love life. It's a very interesting. I do recommend if you are a Shakespeare nerd, you should go out and look at these conspiracy theories just because they're very entertaining. You can kind of see how people really want Shakespeare to be for them because Shakespeare is so universal that people really want Shakespeare to be connected to them somehow. And I think it's very sweet. That being said, back to our regular schedule programming.
So one of the things about The Tempest that I enjoy because of it being one of his later plays is it does seem like it's a wrapping up of a career. Like he knows he's not going to have – he's going. I think he writes for another 4 years. No, another 2 or 3 years and then goes – I can't remember.
He dies in 1616. This is 1611. So he does kind of periodically write for the next couple of years.
But with other playwrights.
With other playwrights. But this is like this is kind of viewed in Shakespeare canon as one of his last plays.
Yeah. And I think the thing is that the end when there's a big theme through this. And a lot of people, when they interpret this play, is that this is a summation of his career, and that he's kind of Prospero. The Prospero character is him, and all the different things in around that character are people, or the part of being a playwright and creating. His writing is the magic is a metaphor for his writing and things like that.
Well, so I did add a little bit of things for our little history section. As we have stated multiple times in this podcast, Prospero is usually a man's part throughout this play. But there has been a shift recently. Well, I say recently, but it's been a couple of years, 20 plus years, of this more gender/race neutral portrayal throughout Shakespeare's work. And we can see that with like West Side Story, which is Romeo and Juliet. You also see that with like on stage productions, which I have seen, which it was really hard for me to separate some on stage productions with movies, because most of the time the reason why I do get to see these on stage productions is because they do film them and then put them on like Canopy and Netflix and things like that. So then I do watch them in quote unquote movie form. But
they're staged and it's obviously a stage play.
Yeah, it's obviously a stage play. You can see that with like the Globe Theater, which is like the center of Shakespeare performances and changing of Shakespeare. They did a, in 2019, they did a all black woman cast of Richard II, which I've only seen clips of, and it's really, really good. But you also see that with other cultures as well, like Bollywood adaptations are really popular in Hindu and Urdu speaking countries, because Shakespeare kind of has this universal feeling to it. So you get different cultures and their adaptations of Shakespeare, which is also very interesting.
So do you feel that the music in this interpretation lent to the film, took away from the film, moved the plot along?
I think sometimes the music dampened the importance of what the words were saying, because it felt like a little bit too much that they were relying on music. That being said, I think it was really interesting that they even included music, because there are some parts of the plot where music is really important, with like Ariel and Ferdinand and things like that. And I think the songs with lyrics really added to the story. The heavy metal riffs every once in a while, I was just like, there's a heavy metal riff over some ocean waves. Ooh, you know, and sometimes it just didn't really add to the story. But this is also very interesting, because I remember reading this somewhere. No, I know I read it somewhere, because I literally just read it, that The Tempest was one of a play that he actually wrote in with a composer, a friend of his who was a composer, who wrote some of the songs for him in The Tempest. So it's
kind of like a proto-musical?
It's a proto-musical, which is, you know, there's only two songs in the whole play, or three songs in the whole play if you just read it. But it's very interesting that they added some songs that weren't from the play, but were from Shakespeare, and that they let the characters be a little bit more musical.
Would you recommend this movie to a non-Shakespeare fan?
I do recommend this to a non-Shakespeare watching person, because I think it is straightforward enough that you can dip your toes into a Shakespeare story, but a little bit wacky enough that it's not just straight Shakespeare for 2 hours. There is, you know, cinematic elements. There are slow parts where there's reactions, and there is music, and there is, so it's more like a movie than a play.
Yeah, the cast is amazing.
Cast is amazing, and we've seen all of these cast members before in other things. Some of them are Oscar winners, some of them are Oscar nominees. We see them at the end of their career here, we see them in the middle, we see them in the beginning. So it's like, there are really good.
Yeah.
I think most of them actually go out to do other things past this, the young crowd. So it's like,
no, it's a really good cast. So I think that helps make it when the storytelling kind of sags a little bit. The cast really does a great job of keeping it going.
Yeah, I also think it's really funny that they cast Russell Brand as Trunculo.
Yeah, I mean, they cast the clown as the clown, but I think the thing is that for me recommending this to somebody, I know when it came out, it got mixed reviews. And I always think when plays are made into films, it's really hard to get really good reviews, because film critics kind of sit there with their arms across their chest saying, okay, prove to me this is a film. Although I disagree with you on Fences, because I feel like the staging actually reinforces the relationship. I thought this film did a really good job of breaking out into the environment, that it used the island of Hawaii very well. I would probably say that people who like Shakespeare are going to be the ones that stick to the end, because they want to see the entire performance. I think sometimes, and so that's who I would probably recommend it for. So that's about it. Next week, we are going to continue our Shakespeare conversation with a movie that I picked for Bella to watch.
So thank you guys for listening to this week's episode. We post every Tuesday, and you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Those are the two social medias that we focus on. So if you want to give us a review, suggest a movie, please go follow us on Facebook at The Movie Log and Instagram at The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. Please like and subscribe.
You can get our podcast anywhere where you get podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google, or any other player. If you want to suggest a film, I would suggest going to our Facebook account. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.